We'll now go back to the Vipassana practice. So remember the past few afternoons in our Vipassana practice, we've been doing these four applications of mindfulness. That means to apply the mindfulness that we're cultivating in shamatha, apply that to investigate four objects. First, the body. So we spent 2 days observing the body through doing the body scan, noticing or coming to realize that everything is changing in the body, coming to realize the nature of dukkha, and coming to realize or see that there's no self anywhere in the body. And then yesterday we moved on to the second and third application of mindfulness, looking at the mind. And again, yesterday we initially looked at the reality of the mind and saw that things are rising, passing, rising, passing, rising, passing, to come to see the transient nature of the mind. And then also to have a look, to come to realize dukkha, that things are not in the nature of happiness. And then also briefly we looked at, is there a self there to be found in the mind? So what I'd like to do in this meditation is continue with that practice to... Again, we start by doing the shamatha practice of observing the mind for a little while, and then we'll shift into vipassana mode, where in vipassana mode, of course, we're not simply looking at the mind, we are then investigating what the reality of the mind. So we are questioning these appearances. So again, we can question if they are stable or if they're transient. And also what we're going to do in the second part is to see, is there a self to be seen anywhere amongst those appearances? So we're going to look for that self. So let's do that practice again, and then we'll go back into the text. Setting the body into its natural state, a state of relaxation, stillness, and vigilance. Allowing the breathing to flow naturally and effortlessly. And setting the mind in a state of ease and relaxation. In particular, letting go of any expectations for this meditation. And simply allowing the mind to rest in the present moment. Focusing on the sensations of the breath throughout the body. Allowing the eyes to be at least partially open. And bring your attention to your own mind. And observe your own mind. Without following thoughts, without trying to get rid of them. Simply observing them as they arise and pass, without grasping to them, without becoming distracted. So now we can move from shamatha to vipassana practice. So continue to observe your mind and continue to observe whatever is arising in the mind. And then for each appearance that arises, ask the question, is this the self? Is this me, the observer? Or is it merely an object being observed? And then release all appearances. And simply allow the mind to come to rest. Simply resting in awareness itself. Without really doing anything at all. Just be present. Simply being aware of being aware. All sorts of appearances will continue to arise. But now pay no attention to any appearance, no interest in any appearance. Simply resting in awareness itself. Any questions about the practice?
When we switch from samatha to vipassana practice, you said ask two things.
One thing with two answers, two possibilities.
Are we the observer?
No, is whatever appears, is that the self? Is that the me who's observing? Well, it's just another way of saying self. Me, the observer. Yeah. I mean, you can label subject, me, observer, agent, give it many different names. Yes, but now you're making it an intellectual exercise. I mean, intellectually, you probably realize that everything's changing moment by moment, yeah? So if you're looking at this, any object, then why would we seriously ask the question, is that changing moment by moment? Because I know that. Yeah? So why would you ever pose the question in meditation, is that changing moment by moment? Of course I know that. See, this is not the point.
You could see it changing, but to ask if anything appearing in front of you may be the self, it's like subject can't be object and it's obvious.
But exactly. Exactly. It's intellectually obvious. Exactly. But that's not how we behave. That's the problem. We grasp on to an appearance of self as me. So it's completely illogical what we do experientially. There's an appearance of self, which is an object, and we believe that's me experientially. So it's you're right, it's completely illogical, but that's what we do. And so what we're doing in this meditation is to experientially see how absurd that is. Intellectually, yes, of course it's obvious. Intellectually, of course it's obvious that this book at the atomic level is changing moment by moment. Of course that's obvious. Yeah, but
there is a real feeling of presence,
yeah,
which you can eliminate from it.
Right, but again, in this meditation, we are looking directly. We're not turning it into an intellectual exercise. We want to see through direct experience if there's self or not. We don't want to somehow come to a good intellectual idea of who the self is. Because our behaviour is not based on our intellectual idea of who we think we are. Our behaviour is based on our instinctive sense of self, which when we look at it logically, as you said, is completely absurd. And we know that intellectually. The purpose in this meditation is to turn that intellectual understanding into direct experience, to directly see how absurd that is, to directly see that this book is changing moment by moment. That's what we are trying to do in this meditation.
What we see, like in meditation, what we find there are those mental events, like thoughts, and everything else.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just opposite there.
Good. Because experientially, that's where we hold on to the idea of self, at one of those appearances, experientially. As you said, it's completely absurd. But that's what we do in our life. And that's what we need to come to realize in this meditation, how absurd our instinctive behavior is. Yeah.
But I see that self which I'm grasping to in different place.
It depends on the context. It depends on the context. Sometimes we grasp onto part of the body as me. Sometimes we grasp onto an appearance to the mind as me. We grasp onto many things, but anything we grasp onto as me instinctively is always an appearance. So as you intellectually understand, this is completely absurd to think that an appearance is the observer. But that's what we do. That's what we do instinctively. And so that's what we're trying to do in this meditation, is to experientially see how absurd that is. Not just intellectually. We know that already intellectually. Well, we're supposed to try to find an answer to it. Yeah. You know, is there a self there or not? And what we do, of course, in this practice is that we keep looking, and we do this in this meditation with respect to the mind, we can do it with respect to the body, we can do it everywhere. We just keep looking, and at some point it becomes obvious there's no self to be found. And when you come to that conclusion, that's a realization of no self. And then we just hold that experience.
It's more looking and feeling, or is it more intellectual answering?
Well, it's experientially answering. I mean, it's like an example. Let's say there's a person we know, John. We know him. And then there's a room full of people. And so then someone asks you, is John in the room? To answer that question, do you make that into an intellectual exercise? No, you just look. And then when you've looked everywhere, and then you see he's not there, I mean, that's obvious, often a very strong experience, because if you expected him to be there, let's say it's this room and the only doorway in is here, and you're outside and you see him come into the room and there's no other way out, and then immediately you come into the room and you look and he's not here, I mean, you'd be shocked, wouldn't you? So same thing. Now, instinctively, we believe there's a me here for sure, because I've believed in this my entire life. And then we keep looking everywhere, and then suddenly, boom, not there. And it comes as a shock. And then we hold that experience, that not finding, as we're going to see in the text in the Vipassana section tomorrow. So that's what we're doing. See, the thing is that, and I think I've already mentioned it maybe, and we're going to talk more about it tomorrow, maybe even the next day, is that when we do this Vipassana practice, often people, one of the places they go wrong is they turn it into an intellectual exercise. They instead of looking directly, they go, and you ask the question, is there a self, then, or a me, then often based on their intellectual understanding or background, they already have an answer. Oh yes, it's the subtle mental continuum, because I learnt that in my Buddhist teaching, because that's what goes from life to life. Or, no, we're all subtle energy, so I'm just subtle energy, that's me. I know that. So we always come up with an answer, but again, that's an intellectual answer. And I think I already mentioned, if we're getting angry at someone, you know, we're anger coming up, is the me that we're relating to subtle energy field or subtle mental continuum when we're angry? I don't think so. We're relating to this solid me. So that's why it's important in this Vipassana practice not to make it into an intellectual exercise. Otherwise, of course, we'll always come up with an answer. You know, in this practice, you know, we're looking for the self, and then we'll go, of course there's no self there, because everything, there's no observer, because everything's an observed. I know that. And then, of course, we're stuck. We don't go anywhere. You know? To look for the self, no, to grasp for the self is instinctive. So this is what we're going to see tomorrow. So maybe these questions we can leave till tomorrow. But what we're going to see is that me is a construct, and it's a useful, necessary construct. The problem is we don't realise that. Intellectually, we may appreciate that it's just a construct. But again, when we're angry, are we experientially seeing ourselves, the me, as a construct? No. If we were, we would never get angry. It would be impossible to get angry if we could experientially see ourselves, the me, is simply a construct. Then we'd actually be liberated. We'd be enlightened. This is the problem. Again, intellectually, yes, we may appreciate just a merely a construct. It's just a mental construct. And that's correct. But that's not helping us in our life. We need to bring that intellectual understanding into experience. And that's what Vipassana meditation does. Instead of intellectually appreciating this fact, we can directly see that for our own self. We can directly see that the me is merely a construct. Directly. That has a big impact on us. Big. Okay. Let's go back into the text. So we're now sort of going down in page 6, and we just finished the mixing of stillness and movement. And so here, of course, we're in the shamatha practice, and this section of text is we're talking about, as we're progressing in the shamatha practice, observing the mind, and the mind is settling down, and we're starting to be able to observe the mind and the thoughts arising, passing, arising, passing. How are we to sort of continue to sustain that state and continue to move forward? So here it says, or alternatively, use the following method for sustaining the stillness of mind. No matter what thoughts arise, do not stop them. So here again, we're not trying to block them or suppress them. Recognize where they are coming from and where they are going. And by so doing, observe and rest in the nature of those thoughts. So again, by understanding or seeing where that the thoughts are rising from the space of the mind and going back to the space of the mind, understanding their nature of being mere clarity and awareness, then by resting in that, then we're not feeding those thoughts and then they'll slowly subside. And it says here, by resting in this way, movement, meaning thoughts, will eventually cease and there will be stillness. And here again, they use an analogy to sort of exemplify that. It says, it is similar to the analogy of releasing a bird that has been held for a long time on a ship in the midst of a great ocean. So in the old days, you know, when they wanted to know if there's any land anywhere around, they would have a bird on the boat, they'd release it, and the bird would fly off, and then, of course, the bird would be able to see a long way, and if the bird realised there's no land anywhere to be, it would have to come back to land on the boat, because otherwise it would drown. So that was what they used to use, and if the bird kept going in a certain direction, they knew, oh, there's land over there. So it says, sustain this state in accordance with that said in Saraha's Song of Realisation. So Song of Realisation here is the Doha we mentioned. And he says, Saraha, it is similar to how a raven released from its ship circles in all directions and then settles back there again. So similarly here, when a thought releases from the ship of the mind, then it can't go anywhere and it will just simply dissolve back into the mind. So this is an analogy to understand what to do when thoughts arise. And if we continue to do that, then they will slowly settle down and the mind will become very still. And then here's a very nice summary from Yangompa. I think he's a great Tibetan master in the Mahamudra tradition. He says, do not view discursive thoughts as faults and do not intentionally cultivate non-conception. Rest the mind in its natural state and keep a distant watch, and the meditation will arrive at shamatha. So again, thoughts are not problems. Grasping to them is the problem. We're not trying to make the mind still. If we try and make the mind still, it's just going to create more thoughts. All we got to do is rest the mind in its natural state and watch. And then it'll settle down of its own accord and we will come to that still, clear mind of shamatha. And then here's some practical advice coming up. Often in the Mahamudra tradition, there were analogies that were used to help the meditator, the practitioner, to sustain the practice, to understand what to do in the practice. And so here we have 6 analogies to help the practitioner. So let's have a look at those. Furthermore, if the present-day trainees sustain this state of shamatha observing the mind, by way of the 6 methods for resting the mind, they will become kings of this instruction. What are the 6 methods? As said, and so this is coming from a text, Mahamudra text. The first analogy or instruction is rest like the sun free from clouds. And here's a bit of commentary on it below. It says, just as the sun free from clouds remains extremely clear and bright, by focusing on the clear light nature of the mind, it is not obscured by conception, laxity and excitement and so forth. In this case here, I'd like to also read a little bit from His Holiness Dalai Lama's book called the Gelug Kagyu Tradition of Mahamudra, and I think Mick sent you the PDF for that, and so I'm going to read a little bit from that because he also comments on these six just to add a little bit more information. So for the first one then, His Holiness says the following. So if you have the book, it's on page 288, or in the PDF file, it's actually page 173. He says the following. The first Panchen Lama now explains six methods current at his time among all Kagyu lineages for disciples to bring their minds to a state of shamatha. The first is to settle the mind like the example of a sun freed from all clouds, without purposely stopping conceptual thoughts or purposely meditating in a non-conceptual manner. We just vividly focus on coarse primordial mind, the here and now, non-contriving, clear light nature of mind, which, like a sun freed of all clouds, remains always shining and bright, and cannot be obscured by any verbal thoughts, flightiness of mind, or mental dullness. If we vividly focus on mind's shining brightness for a long time, we naturally achieve a state of shamatha. So that's the first one. In the second one, it's rest like an eagle soaring in the sky. And so the commentary on that here from the Panchen Lama, he says, just as an eagle soars through the sky naturally, without much need to flap its wings, likewise, without the mind being excessively tight or excessively loose, sustain this state with a sharp clarity and in a relaxed manner without losing mindfulness and introspection. So here His Holiness says the following for the second method. The second method is to settle the mind like an eagle gliding in the sky. When a great eagle flies through the air, due to its strength, it glides without need to flap its wings furiously like a tiny sparrow. Wherever it plans to go, it simply soars off with great strength, and without flapping its wings, remains gliding aloft in a relaxed state. Likewise, without holding your mind either too tightly or too loosely, we have it soar off into its clear light state with clarity and sharpness, and then let it glide in a relaxed manner without exercising mindfulness or alertness in any extensive, frenetic way. I think that's fairly straightforward. I'll just keep going. If there's any questions about any of these, just raise your hand, and otherwise I'll just keep going through them. The third is rest like an ocean-going ship. And the commentary here from the Panchen Lama, he says, even though a great ocean is buffeted by winds, the waves are not able to disturb a ship even a little. Likewise, when resting the mind on an object, rest without being disturbed at all by coarse conceptions. So here His Holiness says, the third method is to settle the mind like a ship on the great ocean. When the wind is blowing, although trivial waves may rise on the surface of the waters, they are powerless to jostle a great ocean liner. Likewise, when the mind is focused on its object, even if it gives rise to some subtle conceptual thoughts, it is never jostled, even slightly, such that it would churn out gross conceptual thoughts. Thus, even if a thought arises, if we do not make anything special out of it, but just stay placidly as we are for some time, we find we cannot become involved in a mere thought. Again, fairly straightforward, I think. Then the fourth analogy says, rest like an infant looking in a temple. And the commentary on that says, just as when an infant looks inside a temple, they do not investigate the fine details of the pictures, but rather they look without distraction at the overall scene. Likewise, when resting the mind on the object, rest it single-pointedly on the object without investigating whether the objects of the five senses that appear are attractive or unattractive, and without generating attachment or aversion. So here, His Holiness says about the fourth method. The fourth is settling the mind like a baby looking in a temple. When a baby looks in a temple, he or she does not take in with inspection and scrutiny the details of the murals painted on the walls. Just seeing the rough design, the baby looks without becoming involved. Likewise, when the meditating mind is fixed on its object of focus, no matter what sensory objects appear before it, attractive or displeasing, it does not look at them with inspection or scrutiny. The mind just remains single-pointedly fixed on its object. In other words, we look at any external object before us while we are meditating to be just merely a play of light and remain focused instead on our object of meditation. Again, I think it's fairly straightforward. And then the fifth one is, rest like the trail of a bird in the sky. And here the analogy is, just as there is no trail left by a bird in the sky, likewise rest the mind evenly so that whenever pleasant, unpleasant or neutral feelings arise, you don't allow yourself to fall under the influence of any of the three, attachment, aversion or confusion. So here again, His Holiness' commentary. The fifth method is to settle the mind like a sparrow flying through the sky and not leaving a trace. When a tiny sparrow flies through the sky, it leaves no trace. Likewise, when we experience feelings of pleasure or pain or neutral feelings arising during meditation, we let them pass without leaving a trace, not coming under the power of attachment, repulsion, or foolish confusion about them. We remain focused on our object of meditation. And the sixth one is, rest like spread out matted wool. And the commentary is, just as when matted wool is spread out, it becomes soft and pliable, likewise when resting the mind evenly, it becomes free from the coarse contact of the manifest three poisons and lacks it in excitement. Of course, the three poisons are ignorance, attachment, and aversion. The sixth commentary here in His Holiness. The sixth and final method is settling the mind like a matted piece of wool. When a matted piece of wool is placed in water, it loosens up, become pliable and soft. Likewise, when our mind is immersed in absorbed concentration, the manifest aspect of the three poisonous emotions, and similarly our flightiness of mind and mental dullness, loosens and separates out from our meditating mind. Through these methods of resting the mind, the practice will be meaningful. Any questions about any of the six methods? Yeah, I mean, again, what we can do is understand these, and then if we find, we may find one or a couple of them very meaningful or for us, then at some point in the meditation we can remind ourselves to, you know, rest like an ocean-going ship and not allow ourselves to be buffeted by things. So if we find it meaningful, then yes, it could be useful from time to time if we're finding a little bit of difficulty to remind ourselves using one of these metaphors. So that's their purpose, to remind in the meditation and also outside the meditation, is to remind ourselves of what to do in the practice. Yes. We've still got a few minutes, so we can go a little bit further in the text. So then as we progress in the shamatha practice, You know, I said that there's the three qualities of mind that become more and more evident: the clarity, non-conceptuality, and bliss. So here, in the next section, now we're talking about, as we're really progressing to the higher levels of the shamatha practice, what do we experience? So it says here, through sustaining this state in that way, what kind of marks of achievement will be seen? And so here he says, the nature of meditative equipoise is lucid and extremely clear. So again, clarity. Not obscured by anything at all. And since it is not established in any way as a physical entity, it is a pristine emptiness-like space. So this is this pristine emptiness here, meaning vacuity. So again, we come into this very open, spacious, non-conceptual state. Moreover, whichever of the good or bad objects of the five senses, means pleasant, unpleasant, that appear, they adorn vividly, just like reflections in a clear mirror. And the experience that dawns is beyond identifying it as this or that. So, as we progress in the shamatha practice and the mind becomes more and more clear, more and more stable and non-discursive, then we experience that open, spacious, vacuous state. And here it says that then, because we have that very stable and clear state, then anything that appears, appears very vividly and very clearly to the mind. And also this state of open, spacious clarity, we can see very clearly, but it says the experience is beyond identifying it as this or that. So it's not like we're seeing a thing, you know. If someone were to ask us what you're experiencing, we'd go, you know, it'd be difficult to describe. We couldn't say it's this, it's that, because it's this open, spacious, clear, non-conceptual state. So this is, of course, as we're achieving the higher stages, getting closer to shamatha. Remember, from stage 7 and 8 onwards, we can now, by stage 8, all we need to do is a little bit of effort, and then it's spontaneous. We can sustain this open, spacious, still state long periods of time. And then by stage 9, it becomes completely spontaneous, effortless, this state, this open, spacious, still state. We're in equipoise, meditative equipoise. So remember, stage 8 was single-pointed, so it means single-pointed means non-discursive, and then stage 9 was setting in equipoise, complete balance, completely spontaneous. So this is what we're describing here, these higher stages before shamatha. But then it goes on to say, and I'll just read it and then we'll comment on this part the next session. No matter how stable such a concentration may be, and remember stage 8 and 9 are very stable, if it is not imbued with the bliss of physical and mental pliancy, it is merely a single-pointed mind of the desire realm. So remember, even stage 8 was called single-pointed mind. So stage 8 and 9 are still what's called the desire realm. The realm that we exist in is called the desire realm, mainly because the driving force is craving attachment. And so the mind, the coarse mind that is active, is engaging in this world. But as we go up in the stages of shamatha, then even at this stage 8 and 9, which is single-pointed, spontaneous, clear, we're still in that state of mind, is still considered to be within the desire realm. But then when we achieve this bliss of physical and mental pliancy, which I think we already mentioned, then, and we come into shamatha. Shamatha is actually beyond the desire realm, because that state of shamatha, now there's no more any craving and attachment for any of this. While you're in that state, of course, I'm talking about. So that mind is said to be have gone beyond the desire realm into what's called the form realm. The form realm is a realm of subtle form. And the mind, of course, our body is still in the desire realm, but someone who's in that state of shamatha, their mind has really transcended the desire realm. Of course, when they come out of the meditation, their mind comes back into the desire realm, but that state of mind of shamatha is beyond the desire realm, because we've, that mind has gone beyond craving attachment to the desire realm. And then, of course, we can develop higher levels of samadhi, those jhanas which we briefly mentioned, the four dhyanas. They also belong to this what's called form realm. And we can cultivate these levels of samadhi. And by cultivating these levels of samadhi, this can create the cause to be reborn in that subtle plane of existence in the next life. So by cultivating the particularly the jhanas, which are higher levels of samadhi than shamatha, we can be reborn in such an existence in the next life. And that's called the form realm. And then if we go on higher and develop these, what I mentioned, I think, samapattis, these high levels of absorption, which actually the mind transcends form, we go beyond that, because we discriminate everything as space and consciousness and nothingness, so the mind goes beyond even discriminating form, then the mind at that level is said to belong to what's called the formless realm, because the mind has gone beyond discriminating any form. And those formless absorptions, if we cultivate them, can create the cause to be reborn in that formless realm. And in that formless realm, of course, there's no physical body. It's just a mental state. So we can, through cultivating these higher levels of jhanas and absorptions, create the cause to be reborn in those such realms in the future life. Of course, here in the Mahayana, we can develop shamatha and we can develop the jhanas and even the samapattis. But of course, the purpose for developing them is as a basis for vipassana practice, not so that we can be reborn in those realms in the future life. I think I was mid-sentence, wasn't I? So if this concentration, he's talking about this stage 8 and 9 now, is not imbued with the bliss of physical and mental pliancy, it is merely a single-pointed mind of desire realm. Whereas concentration that is so imbued, meaning once we achieve this physical and mental pliancy, it's said to be the mind of shamatha. It is the source of many excellent qualities, such as extrasensory perception and paranormal abilities, and in particular the Arya paths of all three vehicles are attained in dependence upon it. So I'll comment on that in the next section, and then there's just a little bit to left, and then we've finished the shamatha section of the text. So I think we'll complete the shamatha section of the text in the next session, and then tomorrow morning we'll start the vipassana part of the text. So let's have a tea break and come back at 5 o'clock.